K-Mud Podcast presents.
Hi, everybody. This is Gray Shaw for the Southern Hobo Fire Safe Council, and this is Fire Radio. Tonight, we're happy to have Jonathan Lehman, Lost Coast Tree and Habitat, with us tonight to talk about the fuel reduction work that's been happening in a couple of places.
We're going to be talking about fuel reduction in the woods for the purpose of fire protection, talking about fuel reduction. And that's something that is being done on contract, and it's also something that you can do yourself. We're going to be covering it from both of those angles. Jonathan has been working as a crew of his own, and the two projects where he's been working are in Salmon Creek and in Shelter Cove. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Gray. Pleasure to be here.
Great. So why don't we start by talking about the project that's close to my home, the Salmon Creek fuel reduction.
Okay. Well, that's a really exciting one, and it's been coordinated and administered by the Humboldt County Resource Conservation District and funded by a CAL FIRE Wildfire Prevention Grant. And its main aim is to strengthen existing ingress and egress corridors along Salmon Creek and Thomas Roads and beyond. Also to open up currently closed roads for emergency evacuation that are closer to your neck of the woods. My understanding is there's some aim to open up a path from Thomas Road to Seeley Creek in the long run. And it's going as far as out as Canoe Creek. Our RCD hopes to cover 2,020 acres over the next 2 years. Currently, my crew, Lost Coast Tree and Habitat, is working on it. And recently, the Bryceland Fuels Reduction crew has started, joined RCD and the effort, and they're working on Salmon Creek Road going beyond Thomas Road after some recent environmental concerns were mitigated or approved.
So you say Bryceland Volunteer Fire Department has been joining you?
Yes.
And so they are getting paid by the same CAL FIRE funds?
That's my understanding.
Okay. Has CAL FIRE itself been out there doing any of this work?
Not that I've seen.
Okay. All right. And when did you start?
We broke ground on October 21st.
Okay. And do you have an end date that you're targeted for?
Currently, for our contract, we were scheduled for 40 days of work, and that's set to end around February 21st. The Bryceland Fuels crew just started about 2 weeks ago, and I expect that they've got probably about 25 working days on the ground, give or take a few. So probably a month or two. And it's my understanding that there's a lot more work to be done. I don't know what the exact timeline on that is.
You should probably describe for the benefit of the listeners what the work is. I'm pretty sure most people might not be so aware of what, say, a shaded fuel break is.
Okay, right. So we are covering our prescription, as the industry term, is to create a shaded fuel break going 100 feet from the center line of Salmon Creek and Thomas Roads in both directions of the road. We are to cut most trees that would be considered invasive under 8-inch DBH. That's diameter at breast height, so about chest height for the average person. And then limbing trees larger than that or different trees that the biologist aims to preserve, oftentimes maples, various oaks, madrones, limbing those up 15 feet from the lowest branch point, or from the ground to the lowest branch point, clearing out brush and everything. The interesting thing about this Salmon Creek Fuels Reduction Project is we've got a biologist named Kyle Keegan that's on contract working with us, and he's added another layer of for lack of a better word, mindfulness in what we're doing. And it's been a learning curve for everybody.
And he's actually a Salmon Creek resident himself.
He is, yes. And he really understands the area. Some of the areas in the lower watershed, we've really been preserving a lot of cedars where they're a bit more rare.
These are incense cedars, right?
Correct. And then as we've been getting into the upper watershed, we've had license to take a bit more. A lot of the property owners are pretty attached to them. And we do want to work with the property owners to honor their values and attachments and what's important to them in the community. And so we're not trying to take anything from anybody that's important to them. And we're always negotiating and balancing what is best for the community and best for the aims of the project and best for the environment as well.
All right. So the balance that you refer to would be a balance between the ecological objectives and the, say, human objectives of field reduction. Maybe you could kind of depict that in terms of what the contrast would be between a shaded field break and some other kind of treatment, like the kind of the work that PG&E, for instance, has been doing.
That was a big concern with the residents of Salmon Creek when we first got our boots on the ground. And is this going to be something like PG&E was doing? And a lot of what we witnessed with PG&E as a community was a brush left in place where they cut it. And we've heard from residents that brush was left going hundreds of yards back along power line right-of-ways, that it was just, you know, reckless cutting and leaving it. And I can understand their perspective from a cost point of view, but it's not really responsible forestry or ecology, and it really left a bad mark for everything that RCD and we were trying to accomplish. As we got into our groove, the community started to feel a lot more comfortable with what we were doing, and we've been cleaning up some of the mess that they left, whether or not it's been lop and scatter, and allowing the elements to return that material back into the earth and allow it to become nutrients and habitat, or if we've been chipping it or piling it into burn piles for burning at a later date.
Now, you're talking about the work that's happening along ingress and egress routes, and I think that's where you're focused right now, right?
Correct.
And so those ingress and egress routes, I think there are five of them that are planned for Salmon Creek, right? And then so one of those actually goes right to our curtilage. I happen to be aware of that. Maybe you could talk about the kinds of issues that you run into with roads that have world, say, forestry, logging tracks, and other roads that maybe run through private property and you have to deal with boundaries and people's property rights.
Well, boundaries are always a thing to deal with. Fortunately, the team at RCD, Katrina Henderson and Charlotte, who I'm in touch with on a more regular basis, are really good with contacting property owners and really getting a good grip on their concerns. And we generally have some landowner specs and really great maps to work with where we have geo-referencing for exactly where we are on the property. And we do try to touch base with the property owners and develop a relationship with them and see what their priorities and concerns are and navigate those. Boundaries are definitely an issue, but I haven't run into a whole lot of those in Salmon Creek as far as honoring the property lines. The scope of work is so big that we usually don't run into a lot of issues with getting 10, 20, 30 feet over the edge of somebody else's property and coming into any conflict with a neighbor that doesn't want something done. Usually the adjacent neighbors are notified, as far as I understand.
Right. And so it's pretty obvious to listeners why you would want to have ingress and egress routes. But maybe you could talk about the particular situation in Salmon Creek in terms of the need for these extra routes.
Absolutely. I was talking with a teller at the credit union recently who lives up Salmon Creek, and she'd spoken to just being fearful of leaving her son at home before he could drive to go do anything, and that there was only one way out, just down Thomas to Salmon Creek Road. And a lot of these properties and the driveways are just lined with fuels. And I've driven through it and just pictured trying to get out in a fire.
And so that's the exact problem that you're addressing.
Exactly.
So that people can actually get out safely on these routes, and the fire crews can work in there safely too.
That is another dimension of it. It's enough trouble for somebody in a Civic or a 4Runner or even a 3/4-ton pickup to get out, let alone a Type 3 engine.
Yeah. And so then one of the other things that I think might come into play is that when there's eventually there's going to be fire. It's fire-adapted landscapes. It's just a question of what kind of fire under what conditions. The fire crews will work in an area if it's safe, and that safety can be contingent, often is, on having their own egress route. And so in my case, I am actually downwind of the predominant Santa Ana wind direction, so it would probably help the fire crew as much as anybody else to be able to use this egress road. Knowing that they had a way out, they might stay and actually fight a building fire longer.
Absolutely. I took Wildland Academy as part of Bryceland Fire Department, as did a couple of my crew members, and that was what you're speaking to is exactly something we learned just last spring about when firefighters are sizing up a situation and a property they want to protect or make a standpoint, that they have to consider whether or not they can get out. A lot of times there's, you know, not adequate ingress egress through, whether or not it's through vegetation or a rickety bridge that they can't trust their engine to go over, and many other concerns. But you spoke to a really good point.
Okay. Let's move on to the next thing. I want to mention that this is a call-in show, and folks who have questions or comments about the content of the show would be welcome to call in. The number of the studio is 707-923-3911. And this is Fire Radio. I'm talking with Jonathan Lehman, Lost Coast Tree and Habitat, who is under contract with Humboldt County RCD, using CAL FIRE funds to do fuel reduction work in Salmon Creek and also in Shelter Cove, which is our next topic. So tell us about the Shelter Cove work.
Well, there's an interesting contrast in the work between Salmon Creek and Shelter Cove. And I should start by saying that the work in Shelter Cove is being funded by USDA. That's a pretty historic grant that Nick Pape had managed to get approved for defensible space and wildfire resiliency on every single parcel within RID's jurisdiction. And so that's not a CAL FIRE grant. It's a federal grant, USDA. And it's rolling out in 5 phases over the course of 3 to 5 years. Trees Foundation has been contracted to coordinate it. And in phase 1, which is taking form, is a more classic defensible space, i.e. Up to 100 feet of defensible space from any structures. And that 100 feet is broken down into 3 zones. Zone 0, which is the 0 to 5 foot space between the structures. Zone 1, 5 to 30. And zone 2, which is 30 to 100. And there's different prescriptions in each zone, but the primary zone of most concern is in that 0 to 5 feet of defensible space.
excuse me. So this is a very different strategy that you're applying here. Instead of opening up or relieving the fuel along corridors for access, you're going in and actually doing almost full landscape treatments in and among the houses.
Exactly. And climbing is climbing and getting 30 feet of clearance vertical separation between the roof line and any tree canopy is part of what's going on Shelter Cove. Another big aspect in differences in what's going on in Salmon Creek and Shelter Cove is the folks at RCD have found that various vines like blackberries and poison oak grow back so fast that it's not maybe I'm not quite encapsulating the idea correctly, but it's not cost effective to spend all this time whacking out blackberries and poison oak. They're going to grow right back. And we're also doing a lot more lop and scatter a certain distance from the roadway. And the lop and scatter has a biological factor for leaving more to come go back into the environment.
So lop and scatter is when you just cut it into small enough pieces that it can decompose.
Yeah, generally 18 inches from the base of the ground without much material around the base of larger trees to prevent carrying a fire and to prevent ladder fuels from being caught and going up into the higher canopy.
With the idea being that the material that's close to the ground isn't going to carry such a high flame.
Right,
length.
Right. And it just kind of breaks down over the next couple of years. Where in Shelter Cove, where it's very much landscaping and it's a lot clearer instruction. Maybe that's not the right thing to say. It's
the
prescription is much more straightforward, mm-hmm. without as much room for interpreting. And
you have a lot more species too, because of all the horticultural plantings.
Exactly. Yeah, the landscaping. A lot of folks are pretty attached to their landscaping, and in all cases, we're not trying to take anything from everybody. If folks really like whatever landscaping they have in the 0 to 5 or the 5 to 30 zone, we encourage them to allow us to cut out any dead material and remove any debris. Mm. And to trim it back as close to 5 feet from their structure as they're comfortable. And at the end of the day, as long as they're able to keep that vegetation green throughout the summer, the folks that are running the show feel like that's a fair compromise.
Okay. Well, so it sounds like a huge job doing all of Shelter Cove. How much area is that?
That's beyond me to even grasp. Yeah. I'm not the only contractor doing it. There's five other contractors involved with it. As far as I can tell, I think RID and Trees Foundation have done a great job of keeping it local by breaking it up into small pieces that made it unattractive to one really big contractor, giving an opportunity for any contractor that's qualified. And so as far as I can tell, all the contractors that are part of it are from Northern California. And four of those five are from Humboldt. Two or three of them are from Southern Humboldt specifically.
Excellent. Oh. Do you get into some of the same issues with boundaries, or is it fairly clear where you are?
There's the boundaries are a bit more of a tightrope walk in Shelter Cove for sure.
Okay. But the environmental concerns are probably very different.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about these two projects now. One is egress routes and shaded field breaks along the major arteries in Salmon Creek watershed, along Salmon Creek and Thomas Road. Second is sort of in between throughout the development in Shelter Cove. And so maybe we could talk a bit about, I think you wanted to discuss the organizational complexities of these two.
Yeah, absolutely. What made me think of organizational complexities is that we had, when I say we, I mean me and my crew and the people who were organizing the Shelter Cove project. We're talking about it for 2 years, and it felt like it was a very long time thing coming. And now that I'm reaching out to homeowners and speaking with them, and they're like, oh, finally, I didn't think this was ever going to happen. And it's nice to actually get it going. But when I think about all the different agencies involved in this, and I know the first phase has, I believe, I want to say, I could be wrong, but 562 private residences that are occupied dwellings, and RID and Trees Foundation are doing home risk assessments at each one, and then getting these home risk assessments uploaded into this software by a group called Madronis, based down in Sonoma and Marin, and they create a great treatment plan and home risk assessment report that's great for the homeowner and great for my team.
And so is that a template that you work with in the field?
Yeah. It gives us a map, a treatment plan, home hardening, like all different aspects of defensible space, and even a reporting form. And we even run into our own issues with that. Sometimes the homeowner's understanding is that it's going to be 100 feet of defensible space, and oftentimes that 100 feet of defensible space runs into three of their neighbors' properties. Or maybe they own the property next door, and just through whatever it is with so many agencies, that their property next door is not the property that's being done right next to theirs, and they're wondering why. And it takes some getting used to and getting into a workflow. And all of these properties are going to get done in the coming months and years. But it's always a little bit of a surprise when a homeowner thinks they're going to get more than they're getting in that moment, and something they want is outside of the boundaries. It's on their neighbor's property. And we're like, okay, well, we'll be getting to your neighbor's property after their assessment is finished. And then the full 100 feet of defensible space will be complete. And usually it just takes some talking and everything works out. But that's where boundaries can come into play.
Well, there are a couple of themes that you touched on there that I want to stress, is that one is we're in an unprecedented situation. We've never, as a society, had to confront fuel reduction before. It's just never happened in history. And it's because we've never previously suppressed fire. And now we've changed the fire regime of an entire landscape, and we're having to deal with the consequences. So we're having to figure it out on the fly. And also the other theme that you touched on is that fire doesn't respect boundaries that we identify with. It's got its own agenda, if you will, and it will just go wherever physics dictates that it will go. So those are issues that need to be remembered when we're working with fire and with each other around fire.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we've talked about this work in terms of what you and other crews are doing out in the field under contract. And you might mention where the funds are coming from in terms of the federal freeze on funds that is coming up. Not all of the funds that are being frozen apply to this work.
Correct. That was a big scare on Tuesday, actually, with the USDA. And I talked with the folks at RID and Trees Foundation over the course of the afternoon, and talked about hurrying on down there. Maybe I make it a short day in Salmon Creek and run over to Shelter Cove to finish some things. And by the end of the day, the project manager had said, you guys can keep going for the time being. And then by the following morning, I don't want to say that the White House's administration had made a complete U-turn or 180. Well, a couple hours after, I should backtrack a moment and say a couple hours after I got notified that we may have to stop work like in the next few hours in Shelter Cove, a judge put like a temporary hold on that order to freeze the funds from the White House. And there was some discussion on whether or not it was a 48-hour hold or a hold until the following Monday. But whatever it was, the people in charge of the project said, go ahead and keep scheduling work for the time being. And then within 24 hours of that, it sounded like the White House administration had made a U-turn on anything involving Shelter Cove. Salmon Creek wasn't a part of that. It's funded by CAL FIRE.
Right. So that's a state program. That's the point I was about to make is the feds through the USDA have been funding the Shelter Cove project, but that's not the situation over in Salmon Creek.
Correct. I'm probably talking out of my depth, but I was in some conversations today where there was some discussion of the Inflation Reduction Act and how that is being affected by the freeze, and that had more to do with the National Resource Conservation.
NRCS, Natural Resources Conservation Service.
Yeah, some of their stuff. But as far as I can tell, for the time being, it's not affecting what's going on in Shelter Cove.
Okay. Well, that's good. So then, as I said, we've been talking about the work in terms of work that has been done by contractors, yourself included. We could talk in general terms also about the wisdom of doing fuel reduction work in the wintertime. I think it's a great topic, and I bring it up because I think many people don't imagine that we would have anything to talk about in terms of fire in wintertime, but we actually do.
Yeah, definitely.
So why would you do fuel reduction work in the wintertime? Why is it a good idea?
Well, the first thought that comes to mind is kind of like the old gym saying that a summer body is built in the winter, and you're at a much better point to – you don't have to catch up so much by the time fire season rolls around. By the time May's here, all you got to do is knock down all your grass and weeds with a weed eater, and you're pretty good to go if you've been on top of it. The as a professional, what I really love about it is I don't have to worry about heat stroke or dealing with 95 to 105 degree temperatures and all that. There's also bear with me. There's also you have all the options for processing open. From obviously you can burn. It might be a little harder to start a fire. You can do the chipping if that's what you like, and lop and scatter is great too. You have all those options open to you. Oftentimes when we start making burn piles in the summer, we have to put them somewhere and drag them to a certain distance from a drip line of a tree.
Yeah, the irony being that you're actually creating fuel.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. And it's really easy to get rid of it right then, especially if you've got a lot of fur.
Right then being in winter.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And it does seem like it's a bit harder to get something going, but there's usually enough dead fur or pitchy stuff around. You might be blessed to have some eucalyptus trees on your property that'll light up really easy.
Mixed blessing there.
Yeah, right, at least in the winter. And it can help get a burn pile going pretty quickly without too much effort.
Because of the resin.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
I want to mention that you're listening to Fire Radio on KMUD, and I'm talking with Jonathan Lehman
of Lost Coast Tree and Habitat. He's one of the contractors who is doing fuel reduction work in Southern Humboldt on a couple of projects we've been discussing. By the way, we are both arborists. We speak the same language when it comes to pruning and removing trees. You wrote down here, I was glad to see this in your notes, that it's a good time of year to practice pruning techniques, and we can call it target pruning when you're cutting a branch back, but it's also referred to in a much more technical term, which is coded. And that's something that has to be explained, I think.
Yes. Compartmentalization of
decay
in trees.
Yes.
And the idea goes that trees never really heal. They compartmentalize their wounds. Thanks for tying that back into our discussion of the advantages of doing fuels reduction in the wintertime. All the deciduous trees, it's much better to prune them while the leaves are off. Part of it, for several reasons, the insects are dormant too, so a lot of the pestilence is not going to enter the wounds. Additionally, the deciduous trees have drawn back all their energy and nutrients into, great, you could probably like describe this better than me, but drawn them back into the deeper parts of the tree, into the cambium or beneath the bark.
Well, they store energy is the basic
They store
idea.
Their energy. And when we cut a white oak or a maple branch in the middle of summer, we're cutting off a lot of its energy that it's put out into the leaves. And so it's the tree's going to do a lot better. Any orchard tree is going to do a lot better cutting it back in the wintertime before mid-February.
Yeah, so you're working with the tree's natural processes.
Yes. Yeah.
To give it the best advantage it could have if you're going to do cuts like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. And then the added bonus is that you don't have all the leaves to deal with processing or disposing of or dragging to a burn pile or your chipper or wherever you're taking it.
Right. You have less volume. And then also those leaves will have fallen off and begun to become integrated into the soil.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. So those are really good reasons for doing this work in the wintertime. Also, I think you would probably add that it's more comfortable just to be working out there in the wintertime.
I love it.
Yep. Oh, we have a call. All right, caller, you're on the air. Go ahead and join us on the air.
Hi. I know that a lot of this is on private land, but I was just wondering if there's going to be an opportunity to collect some of the down trees.
Collect them?
For firewood, for people. Can people come and collect some of the debris?
This is Jonathan. Absolutely. People can come collect debris. We've been pretty open to, if we're working in Salmon Creek and we come across a community member that would like to take home some chips or to use in their garden or to get firewood, we absolutely will cut it to spec and keep it on the side of the road, or we'll work with you to pull your dump trailer or regular trailer or pickup truck up beside our chipper and shoot it in. There's some opportunities that are better than others due to the narrowness in certain areas of Salmon Creek Road and traffic at certain times of day. We have to keep one lane open. But we are open. We would love for people to take some wood off of our hands.
Okay, that's awesome to know. And to hook up with something like that, who would we call, or is there some contact point?
You could get in touch with me. I'll be my. You could contact me through email at lostcoasttreeandhabitat. That's all spelled out at gmail.com. My cell phone number is 707-496-9607. If you're in Salmon Creek and you see any of the guys with a red helmet, they're the foreman. There's three of us wearing them, Jonathan, Joe, and Tyler. And feel free to just give us a wave or flag us down, and we'll be happy to talk to you and work out something with you.
Cool. Thanks. Another question is, do you know if there's going to be a similar program going on out west, like Edersburg area?
I don't know of anything exactly at the moment. I know that over the summer and earlier in the fall, Bryceland Fire, was their fuels reduction crew, was doing about 90, 95 different properties in between Redway, Edersburg, Whitethorn. And it's my understanding that they recently wrapped that. But what, you know, the Fire Safe Council and Trees Foundation is always, and RCD is always looking for new ways and new areas to really make the entirety of Southern Humboldt more fire resilient.
So the funding could spread out to different areas.
I would say so.
Okay.
In this particular project, where the funding's already been allocated, that I'm working on, it's pretty allocated here, but I would recommend getting in touch with Trees Foundation or the Southern Humboldt Fire Safe Council or the Humboldt County Department of Natural Resources and giving them your concerns and your two cents and getting your neighbors involved. And I think that could be a really effective way to get something started in your own neighborhood.
Yeah, that's basically how it got started in Salmon Creek. There was a real need identified in terms of safety, and that led to the grant money.
Thank you so much.
Very
welcome. Thanks
for calling.
Yep.
Bye-bye. Bye. So then as long as we're talking about options for people, we might talk about ways that they could do some of this work themselves. I mean, we're kind of leading into that when we talk about how to do this work and we talk about pruning cuts. But what would it look like for someone to treat their own property? What advice would you give to somebody who wanted to take this on themselves?
I would start with a few tools. A nice strong weed eater, maybe a brush blade like the Archer dual flanged brush blade. It's great at mulching down huckleberries and huckleberries and poison oak and all that stuff. Personally, I like to run through an area with a brush blade, clearing out paths around the base of trees, and then once I have some nice work to start felling trees, and I'm not making a bigger mess felling trees on top of huckleberries and making it harder to pull out, I start taking the trees down. And if it's wintertime, it's nice to pile the brushes close to the area that they were felled within, you know, at least, I like to keep it 10 feet of a drip line. For safety. I know other people put them much closer.
Tell folks what a drip line is.
The drip line is the outermost area of a tree's canopy, an adjacent tree's canopy, or any tree around you's canopy. If you've got a nice big oak or fir that branches are spreading out 20 or 30 feet from the trunk, the drip line is that radius from the center of the trunk to the outer edge where rain drips off the outermost.
So you'd stack brushes outside the drip line so that if it were to burn, it wouldn't light the canopy on fire.
Exactly.
Okay, got it. All right. I think there's a lot to know about doing fuel reduction in terms – there's simple principles, but when you are just confronted with a wall of neglected, overgrown, you know, fire-suppressed brush, it can be daunting.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot you can do with
you can learn as you do.
A
you
telescoping pole saw, a chain, a top handle, or a regular, even a steel 171 or 250, and a weed eater, and it's kind of you get started doing it, And it's really satisfying to actually see the change come.
You get better at it pretty quickly, I think. And I think most people who live in Southern Humboldt are pretty familiar with some of these ideas.
I think so, too.
In the woods. So you might talk a little bit about things to look out for. Again, very common knowledge for people who work in the woods and live in the woods in Southern Humboldt, but what to look out for when you're working in wintertime.
Right. The safety is the most important thing. Storms are constantly coming through in the wintertime, like we're experiencing right now. And I expect a lot of folks and ourselves, when we go out back out to pick up where we left off last week, are going to see different trees have blown down, different branches in the canopies have broken off. We'll have different widowmakers, so on and so forth. And the ground is really saturated after a big storm. So uprooting is a common thing, as well as more subtle things to look out for, aside from your footing in the saturated soil, is native seed beds. And it's a big thing really not to disturb those. It really helps for the native seed beds to grow back and to have a chance to overtake in the long run things like Scotch broom and Himalayan blackberries that we're trying to overcome. In addition to that, when you start getting wet and cold, your morale can really start suffering. You'll probably be working, I know we work at a little bit slower pace in the wintertime, just watching our footing, making sure we don't slip, trip over different things. In the summertime, you got to worry about slipping on dry tan oak leaves as well. But it's a little different in the winter. And just making sure you've got the workwear that's going to keep you comfortable and feeling all right. A lot of times, as long as I keep moving, I can keep working. But when I stop for lunch, then I start getting cold and maybe I put on a new base layer and some new socks.
I find it's really easy to forget to continue drinking water in the wintertime because you're not sweating.
Absolutely.
And so it's just a thing to remind yourself of.
Yeah, every breath lets out, dehydrates you a little more.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to expand a little bit about on the topic of native seed beds. One of the things I learned from some of the tribal folks who we've had contact with on this topic is that when you broadcast chips and you're blasting out of a chipper, or if you're mowing or even doing lop and scatter, you can actually smother some of these native seed beds.
Yeah.
And so you don't want to pile up too much stuff. And it's good to process it. You can do it in various ways, like burning, chipping, but not to accumulate too much in any one spot, because you'll probably cover up and eliminate whatever is underneath.
Absolutely. That's actually part of the prescription in both of our projects, that we should not have chip piles deeper than 3 inches, and we should not have them in drainages or at the base of trees. It's pretty obvious at the base of trees where cutting off oxygen and light, and it's going to introduce rot to it as well. And drainages, it's going to go into the watersheds and inhibit salmonoid traveling. Salmonid, my pronunciation's awful.
Well, I think it's actually not so intuitive to folks that when you pile chips and maybe soil and debris up against a trunk, it does smother the trunk. The tree actually has to breathe through the trunk. And it's only when the tree reaches underground that the situation changes, and you don't have to obviously be concerned about burying it.
Right. And you spoke to me once before, a year or so ago, about inhibiting fungal growth in certain areas of putting chips over too much. So there's a lot to look out for when you're dispersing chips, definitely.
So this is something that everybody can do on their own, depending on their initiative and their abilities to take care of their own situation in fuel reduction. If there were a way for people to get involved, what would that be? Otherwise, besides doing it themselves, I mean.
Right. Well, if you are a resident of the Salmon Creek watershed, I would recommend and are interested in, right now we're focused on performing work on private properties in multiple areas of Salmon Creek. Right now we're in between the freeway and the school, and we're continuing to move westward. But I would contact Charlotte, CHARLOTTE, at hcrcd.org.
That stands for Humboldt County Resource Conservation District.
Thank you. And if you're a resident of Shelter Cove, you can reach out. One easy way is to go to the Trees Foundation homepage, and you'll see a link to their sign-up form for the Shelter Cove Wildfire Resiliency Project. But the exact email address is coveds@treesfoundation.org. That is COVEDS at treesfoundation.org. That's trees plural. Also, if you had any questions about this or wanted to get any more input before contacting the officials, you can feel free to reach out to me. Again, my email is my business name, all spelled out, Lost Coast Tree and Habitat at gmail.com.
Well, Jonathan, I really appreciate your input on this topic. You've had a lot of really valuable experience, and you've earned the money that you make doing it. It's something that needs to happen. It's a service that needs to be conducted, and it's something that is the sort of vanguard. You're like the leading edge of sort of change in management that we're doing as a society, as residents here, so that we can continue to live here without burning up. There's one thing I wanted to add that's sort of not on the menu here tonight, but it does tie in, which is biochar. There's a way to turn brush into something that you could use as a soil amendment that actually adds soil productivity over time just by virtue of attracting more microbial life every year successively. And so biochar is just charcoal that you make from whatever biomass you have on hand. But if you're doing fuel reduction, you have a lot of biomass, and you don't really need to do anything more than just light it on fire and put it out when the flames disappear. That's called a conservation burn. And that charcoal can then just be left on site. You don't have to pick it up and move it around, although you could. You could take it and mix it with compost and put it in your garden. So it's just a sort of captive resource that's available from doing this type of work. And it's not necessarily practical for a crew to do it, although some do. But you could certainly do it on your own if you're doing things that way. I'm going to be doing a demonstration of making biochar on February 24 out at the Bureau of Land Management facility in Whitethorn with the help of the CCC crew from Fortuna. They are going to bring a kiln to make biochar that I've used on other projects making biochar from fuel reduction work in other parts of the state. And you can come and see that being done. That'll be February 24. We'll probably start about 10 a.m. This is, however, contingent on weather being in prescription, because the site is
under a smoke management plan with the North Coast Unified Air Quality Management District, and it has its own criteria for compliance. So that's the only caveat, that we may have to not do it on that day on account of the weather. And it will be under the direction of Brian Boatman, who is the local guy at BLM there. He or one of his staff people will be the burn boss for this. I will be there to talk about biochar, explain what it is, how to use it, and the actual burn will be conducted by somebody else. But that's a way to find out about biochar. I just wanted to slip that in before the end of the hour.
It's a great skill to have, knowing how to make biochar.
Yeah. Let's see. Is there anything else that we've left on this list? I really wanted to give people a sense of what fuel reduction looks like. Can they just go to Salmon Creek and see the work that you've done?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd say you will. Folks will see the majority. We started working from the Wallen property, if you guys know where that is. But the real bulk of the work started at Thomas Road, where Salmon Creek intersects. And it's not completely continuous because there's different property owners that have signed up at different times. But you'll definitely see where it's happened. I think the one other item that we maybe we're talking about discussion is how much is enough versus how much is too much. And we probably hadn't a chance to touch on that. And just for reference to ladder fuels, 15, like if you're more than 30 feet from your structures, 10 feet clearance from the ground is enough. And if you're within 30 feet of your structures, CAL FIRE recommends that you have 15 feet of clearance from the ground. And it's a really slippery slope to say how much is enough, especially with shaded fuel breaks and property lines like you made reference to, Gray. But I just wanted to slip that reference in that I missed in terms of giving some kind of metric.
Yeah. So there isn't one single level of fuel reduction that applies in all cases, and different contractors will see different ways of doing the same job, and different homeowners will have different priorities in terms of what to leave and what not to. And whatever you do will help.
Absolutely. The less fuel, the better.
Yeah.
For the most part.
The same principles apply, but the change that you make will be a matter of degree. And I think I mentioned, but I want to say again, this is a fire-adapted landscape. Fire belongs here. It's part of the ecology. And what we're doing is making it possible to coexist with it.
Yeah.
We have taken that away from ourselves by suppressing fire, and we're trying to put it back. We're trying to bring back what we call healthy fire so that we don't end up with unhealthy fire. It will come back one way or the other. So either we bring it back on terms that we select, or it will select terms of its own. So it's all good work, and it's an opportunity for us to team with us and with nature. Native Americans are doing this a lot longer than we were on the same landscape, and they are willing to work with us. So, Jonathan Lehman, Lost Coast Tree and Habitat, thank you for joining us in the studio tonight to talk about fuel reduction in winter in Salmon Creek and in Shelter Cove and some of the principles involved. For the Southern Humboldt Fire Safe Council, this is Gray Shaw, and this has been Fire Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, Gray. Okay.
This has been a KMUT podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, kmud.org.